So as I mentioned, Stefan is presenting tonight if he gets his mic problems sorted out. If not, we'll postpone his portion until next week, I guess, at this point. So welcome all. Reminder, we are recording the audio, and the audio recording along with the contents of the chat window and a PDF of the deck from tonight will be posted on the OPCUG website later on this evening. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away. Alan, unmute yourself. There we go.
That's what I was looking for, the control. Okay, yeah. Thanks, Chris, and good evening, everyone. As usual, we have a full house tonight, so we'll get right to it. And I'm going to throw it right back to Chris, who has a specific share for us.
Yeah, I just came across this SANS, which stands for Sysadmin, I forget, a network and security. They have a thing out now, hashtag secure the family, in appreciation of Cybersecurity Awareness Month, which is on this month. And so they have a bunch of content on the website. It's aimed mostly at beginners. Also, very good information on protecting your devices, your Wi-Fi, and things like that, threats in the home, all of the things you see bulleted there. So I highly encourage people to check that out. I will be posting that URL into the chat window, and as well, it will be going up in on the website tonight. So good information, highly recommend it, and especially if you know some people that maybe are new to computers and things like that, there'd be a lot of really easily digested information in that.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And the second item we have is a question which comes from Stuart. And he was using his computer when Glasswire, which is a software firewall, said that SharePoint was trying to access the network for the first time it had tried. His problem is he doesn't remember installing this program, and a Google search doesn't provide much useful information. So he's asking, what is SharePoint and why is it running on the computer? So we have some information. We looked up SharePoint, and it's a Microsoft product, but interestingly enough, it's an intranet program. So typically that means it's being used by companies or organizations, typically large entities, that are using internal web pages for their employees. So why an individual user would have SharePoint if he isn't accessing an intranet, I really don't know. But Chris had some information on the Glasswire aspect.
Yeah, because it was Glasswire that popped up, Glasswire is a firewall add-on product that can monitor your outbound connections and let you know what programs are trying to access the internet. And this is how Stu first came across it, was a Glasswire popped up saying that the program was trying to access the internet. So my take is, if Glasswire is indicating that a program is trying to access the internet, then that program is running on your computer. No two ways about it. And so one of the things in the pop-up, you'll see it on the under part of the two rectangles there. There's the program was identified trying to access the internet for the first time, and you can click on the info button, and it will tell you where the executable is running on your computer, which can help you track down things, especially in something like this where, Stu didn't think that he had installed SharePoint. And so I strongly suspect that it was actually coming from an add-on to some other program that installed at least some components of SharePoint in order to provide some kind of functionality, is my guess.
Yeah, and that could be, because I checked on my machine, and I don't have SharePoint installed, but I do have a bunch of files that have SharePoint in the name, and they're icon files and DLL library files, and they seem to be associated with SQL Server, which is a program I installed very recently. So it clearly is possible for SharePoint to be installed with other things. Anyway, we have a first for Q&A this week. We have a question, we have some answers, and we also have a follow-up because Stuart's been looking at this thing and he's tried to uninstall the program and deleted some stuff, but he's still getting a daily error message saying that it can't find SharePoint.exe. And typically he's getting one message a day just in the evening, so clearly Windows thinks the thing exists and wants to deal with it. The interesting thing is, he's got Windows on a laptop and a desktop, and the laptop isn't giving the same problem. It's just on the desktop. And he says he read an article about Microsoft forcing PC health check on systems and wondered if that's related. I suspect it isn't, because this problem has been going on for a little while, and the PC health check installation has been very recent. And I don't see that that would be anything to do with SharePoint. Well, maybe we'll have another follow-up next week when Stuart has either solved the problem or he's buried in Windows messages trying to find it.
There is a possibility I just thought of in that, because it's now in a state where something is trying to run SharePoint.exe, and because Stuart just deleted the executable, it's giving an error message. Now it's a problem of trying to track down, you know, what program is actually trying to load it. And there is a possibility of using some of the sysinternal tools that Microsoft has available. Process Explorer or something like that could possibly track down, you know, what is it that is trying to load it. And but it's going to take a little bit of sleuthing, I think, at this point to try to track down what it is. I don't know. Tricky.
Yeah. Well, if anybody has any bright ideas to pass along, we have the chat window, or send us an email, and we'll certainly make Stuart aware of anybody's thoughts. And in the meantime, Chris has a second share.
Yeah, this is something I came across that it's not all that computer related, but I thought it was fascinating. And it was a study in 1968 by a gentleman by the name of George Land. I'm going to be running a poll in a couple of minutes. And just to let you know, when the poll comes up, it's a little bit lengthy. You have to scroll through it. But there is a maximize button, or you can resize the dialog box bigger when it comes up. So just get ready for that. So this study, George Land, he was originally contracted by NASA to do some kind of study of their people. They knew they had a lot of brilliant people, but they wanted a way to hone in on who was creative, highly creative people within their ranks. And the what he came up with was ultimately very, very useful for NASA. But then Mr. Land decided that he would take this out and start looking at, because the quiz was that he gave, it was very simple. And he thought, well, let's give it to kids and see how they score on this. And he gave it to a bunch of five-year-olds. And then he gave them to the same group of people when they turned 10, I think it was 1,600 people. And he gave it to the same group of people again when they turned 15. And then they later on gave them to a whole bunch of adults, 280,000 adults. And think about what you think they would score percentage-wise in terms of genius level. And so let me call up the poll. And so, again, you can maximize this window or just, stretch on the borders to make it larger, or use the scroll bar to go down. And so there's four questions. So think about what percentage of children age five, scored genius level when it comes to being creative. And then carrying on with the same group of people at age 10, same group of people at age 15, and then how adults responded. So I'll give it about another 30 seconds for people to participate if they so desire, and then I'll end up sharing the results on it. And while that's going on, when you get back to the slides, there is the URL there for an article about it, and I'll be pasting that into the chat window as well. Very interesting, and it includes a TED Talk, a 15-minute TED Talk, where Mr. Land talks about this study that he did and what it really means as far as he's concerned. So I'll give it just another couple of seconds. Okay, we're at 18 people, 19 people. Let's give it to 20 people. There we go, 20 people. So I'm going to end the poll now, and I'm going to share the results. So looks like we had a small percentage thought it was under 25% of children aged 5 were scoring as genius level, and the majority thought in the 50 to 75%. And then when they, it looks like a little bit of a drop going to age 10, and then going up to age 15, high percentage thought 25 to 50%. And then in adults, it looks like the dominant number there is they figured under 25%. So let's take a look at the actual results of this. So if you go to the next build there, Alan. So age 5, 98% of them were actually considered to be creative geniuses. But by the time they got to age 10, these again, the 1,600 same kids dropped to 30%. And then by age 15, dropped to 12%. And they stopped doing this, the follow-up with that those same 1,600 kids because they thought it was too depressing to actually continue along that vein. Because when they got to adults and they went out to 280,000, the numbers got really dismal, down to 2%. So I thought that was really fascinating. Now, go to the next slide, Alan. Some of the things that he talks about is there's basically two ways of thinking about things, divergent thinking and convergent thinking. So divergent thinking is when you're thinking of new ideas, it's the classic brainstorming. And you're trying to think of ways that are completely different from what has happened before. It can be really rough. People come up with weird ideas and things like that. And he says it often happens subconsciously. So this is when you're dreaming and things like that. You tend to be divergent thinking. Convergent thinking is when you start judging ideas. And this is when you get into the things that, why can't this work? You know, it costs too much. We tried it before. That won't work. It just doesn't fit with what we do. It's not in our culture. All those sort of judgment ideas on it. And it's when you criticize and refine and you improve ideas. And that happens more in your conscious thought. Both of those are really important. He puts it as being the accelerator and the brake. And in a car, both those pedals are extremely important. But if you are automatically hitting on that brake all the time, you're not going to get very far very fast. So you need to do these in conjunction. So you need the divergent thinking, you need convergent thinking in order to get forward on things. And he says, we teach children to do the both at the same time, and that just doesn't work. And you really have to split each into a separate activity in order to make each of them more effective. So it was just really cool TED Talk, and I highly encourage people to take a look at it. It was kind of neat.
So Tom's asking, do we teach children to be divergent?
Well, Land says we teach them to do both. That's the problem really is that we're trying to teach them to be imaginative and come up with new ideas, but then we also are trying to teach them to be critical and, you know, how to say, well, yeah, but that's not good because of the following, that sort of idea. So, yeah, take a look at the TED Talk. Really, really interesting.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So moving along, I've talked about the Gary Explains slide at the top is a YouTube video where Gary Sims from Android Authority basically was complaining that he's got something like 8 PCs in his house and none of them will update to Windows 11. And especially one of them is really kind of state-of-the-art almost. But then there's another article, there's a lot of press about Windows 11, And I noticed this one in PC World recently, saying that it's an unnecessary replacement for Windows 10. So my problem, as everybody knows, I think, is that none of my computers are going to upgrade to Windows 11. So I've been taking a look at what would I need to do to move away from Windows and become Windows free and basically use Linux for 100% of my computing. And so far, we're looking at alternatives to things which I do in Windows. And we've looked at the Office suite, and the holdout right now is Excel, and in particular, VBA programming. And so I'm still looking at that. But then there's a bunch of other applications which are third-party programs that I use in Windows. I'm going to start off by looking today at the text editor I use, which is Notepad++. So if you've used Windows Notepad, you'll realize it's a really simple text editor, and it doesn't have a lot of features. By contrast, this Notepad++, the plus means that it's got a lot more features. And the main things that it does that I use, it has, I can edit individual files in different tabs or multiple tabs. And it also supports a bunch of plugins. And one of the plugins I use is to compare two files. So look at the differences in the text. And it also has Notepad++ has other features. It supports programming. So if you write code for HTML websites, then you get support for that in terms of colored headings for different tags and so forth. And it also supports macros, and that's the thing I don't use, but multiple tabs are good, and the plugins. And the multiple tabs, now here's an example, one of the ones you've actually seen, or something like this you've seen tonight. I maintain a file called Q&A index, and it has the date, and I build a list of topics as we build the slide deck as the week goes by. And then tonight, you probably received a reminder by email, and it had this title, and it had some text, and then I basically cut the preliminary agenda here and pasted it into the reminder file, which I then pasted into the email message. So I do that by using the two tabs, and I find that very convenient. An example of the compare plugin would be looking at the new version of the index on the left and an old version of the index on the right. And you can see that below the pink bar here, the text is basically identical. So it's highlighted the stuff which is new. So I can take two files and almost instantly, look at the differences between the two files. So that's really useful. So what am I going to do in Linux? Well, one of the things I can do is basically just look for an alternative program to Notepad++, because Notepad++ doesn't have a Linux version. So if I do a Google search and ask for alternatives, it pops a whole bunch. And the first one it tells me about is called Vim. And I tried Vim, and Vim is a very simple command mode type editor. It doesn't have a GUI. It's not the kind of program, I would use. And below is a program called gedit, the GNOME text editor. I've used that, and it has multiple tabs. My problem with it doesn't have a very nice file open menu. But the middle one here that I've highlighted is called Notepad QQ, and clearly that is a takeoff on Notepad++, and it's trying to be a kind of a clone. So one of the nice things about Linux, I've mentioned this previously, is that it has a software center. So you can open up the software center, type in the program that you're looking for. I just put in Notepad, and then it will search its database, and it will find a bunch of programs that it thinks are going to work. And here's Notepad QQ. So if I click on that, then it tells me all about Notepad QQ, and I have one button here. I just click on that and it starts to install. I get a progress bar here so I know how we're doing. And then when I finished it, I get the ability to launch using this button. But note also that just as it's really easy to install the software, it's also really easy to uninstall it. If I click remove, then it will basically do the install in reverse and remove this program from my Linux system. So Linux, when it's in the software manager, programs are really easy to install and deal with. And the other thing it does is automatically it dumps the program icon to start into one of the menus, and it's chosen to put the text editor into accessories. So if I were to load the menu editor by clicking on the start button down here, choose accessories, then I could drill down to get to the text editor. So it's really easy to run the program. When I run it, this is Notepad QQ running in Linux. And you notice it's almost identical. I've got the reminder.txt file open. I've got the QA index text open in the second tab here. So I've got the same multiple tab editing. The problem with Notepad QQ is it does have some plugins available, but there's no compare plugin. So that could be a downside. However, Linux is interesting because Linux does everything small. And it has a built-in command called diff, which clearly is a difference engine. So if I use the command diff and put in Q&A index.txt and index_old.txt, and I have to put them in inverted commas because of this and sign. And is an operator normally, so you have to kind of hide that in the quotes. But basically, give me the differences between the new file and the old file. And it pumps out a bunch of lines, and that's telling me that these are new lines in this new file. And it's even better than that, because Linux, all its commands are really well documented. So they have these manuals, man pages. So if I go into a terminal, a command window in Linux, and say man diff, it's going to load the manual for the diff command. And basically it tells me how to structure the command, and then what the various switches are to do things. And if I scroll down that list, I come across a couple of interesting switches, minus Y or double hyphen side by side, creates the output of the difference command in two columns. So I can see what's new and what's old in two different columns. And then the second thing I can do is I can use this switch suppress common lines. So I don't see all of the common lines in the file. I only see the differences. So if I use those two switches, so here's my command originally. There's the minus Y switch. There's a suppress common line switch. And now I've got two columns. Here are the new lines in the new file. And normally the old file would be blank because there's nothing there, but I actually added a line so that you can see there is something in that second file, which doesn't exist in the first file. So I really find that really useful. It has multiple tabs, and I can do the compare just using a regular Linux command. So as far as I'm concerned, on my to-do list here, I put a great big tick against Notepad++ because I found a very useful alternative to that.
Alan, before you go on, comment, yep. Question, is there any problem in QQ with Linux Windows line endings? So carriage return line feed as opposed to line feed for text files?
No, I don't. I think you can manage that through the settings, but okay. I never have any problems with it. Those were just straight ASCII text files, and they work perfectly well in both programs, both operating systems.
Okay.
Okay, moving along, if Stefan has his microphone sorted out.
It seems like he has. He unplugged it and plugged it back in. So, Stefan, you are co-host now, so if you want to test your mic. And I'm not hearing anything from you at all, Stefan. So I think maybe your microphone is broken.
Yeah.
So I think let's go on, and we can circle back at the end, and then if not fixed, we'll postpone that until next week.
Okay, sounds good. All right, so the next question we had came in was a user who wants to continue using Microsoft Outlook for his email system, but he's using a BlackBerry and he's looking to change to a new mobile phone and hence a new operating system. So his question is, does he have any reason to choose Android over Apple or vice versa? In other words, which platform would be best for Outlook? And I know Chris has a thought about Outlook.
Yeah, I just did a search on it, and Outlook, as probably a lot of people are aware of, it's very confusing, that name. Outlook Express was the first version of anything called Outlook. Then they came out with their desktop client for Outlook to connect to Exchange Server, and then they came out with Outlook.com web-based email, and then they came out with Outlook clients for the desktop that can attach to either a POP or an IMAP server, and it just goes on and on. But as it looks like currently, there is an Outlook client, full Outlook client for both Android and iOS, free of charge. And so you can download it from either the App Store for iOS or the Google Play Store and on Android. And so if you like Outlook and want to continue using that, it shouldn't be a barrier on either platform. Now, one thing I caution when I take a look at these things where they come out with something that they call Outlook for Android or Outlook for iOS, it may not have feature parity with the desktop client. So I don't know if they are all, if they are both equally capable, if they both have all of the features that are available in the full desktop client. I do not know, but it's free of charge and you could give it a try. Unfortunately, if you're trying to decide between two different phone platforms, unless you find somebody who has Outlook installed on both an Android as well as iOS device, you might not be able to find out prior to buying your device whether one is a better client than the other. But that's the best that I could find at this point in time.
And maybe some people here have have some thoughts on that too.
Yeah, Tom posted something and he said that there's a comparison for Outlook on the web and Outlook for iOS Android, and it's at a comparison table. So presumably there you can go and look and see what features are available in each of the platforms. So good stuff. Thanks, Tom.
So the thought that came to my mind is, you know, which phone do you choose? And I know some people have iPhones, and I know some people, including myself, have Android phones. And so I'm interested to know which phone people chose, and especially if you're a Windows user. A lot of my friends, some of my friends have iPhones, and the reason is because they either have an iPad, which they use a lot, or they have a MacBook, and so they've stayed with the Apple platforms, essentially. But if you're a Windows user, why would you necessarily go to iPhone rather than Android? So that's kind of interesting. And then why would you go to one or the other anyway? And I said I use Android, and I've always thought that Apple had really nice hardware, generally pretty high-end technology, but you generally pay for the privilege. I find them to be relatively expensive. And I'm sure that's the same for phones. I think phones, iPhones start at about $1,000 and go south from there, or go north from there. They go up from there. The other thing people say about Apple operating system is they're user-friendly. They're very easy to use. I never used one, so I don't really know. But one of the downsides, maybe, is that it's a closed system. Everything you buy is proprietary, so there's no third parties typically available. But the other thing in terms of phones is that every time they provide a new operating system, they release it for all of their phones, or pretty much all of their phones. So you get long-term support for the operating system. Now, on the other hand, if you look at Android, you've got a huge range of makes and models, there can be some very expensive, very expensive high-end phones in there that are Android-based, but they also have mid-range and some budget phones. There's a large choice there. People say that Android is much more customizable rather than the Apple OS, which is a bit like Windows and tells you how it's going to work. Android, you can generally change things the way that you want them to be. It's an open source operating system, so there's lots of opportunity for different apps. But the downside, as I've said many times, is that you get very limited support for the operating system. So you buy a new phone, and it's typically only good for 2 or 3 years, and then they cut you off from any updates to the operating system, which includes security patches. So if there's an insecurity and Android shows up, you ain't going to get a patch to fix it. Now, you can extend the life, especially the operating system, if you're willing to move to a custom ROM. But if you've looked at some of my stuff on how to do that, you realize that's not a particularly easy process. So I'm asking people, which do you prefer, Android or Apple? And why? Why did you go with one and not the other? I don't think I see anything in the chat.
Tom had one thing. He talked about Lineage phones. So Lineage OS is actually based on Android 8.1. So although it's not currently really a pure Android operating system, it is based on Android. And he mentions that iPhone SE are cheaper and smaller. He has a link to iOS can be cheap used. Well, if you're talking about used, an Android used phone can be cheap too. Bob Harris says shamefully admits to using Windows PC with iPhone and iPad. Bob, unmute yourself. Tell us why you made the choice to go to iPhone.
He's also saying that his iPhone is 6 years old, so that's that long-term support.
Yeah. And Gail, I know you're an iPhone user. If you wanted to unmute yourself and say, why is it you chose Apple devices? And neither of them wants to speak up and say why. Nobody wants to admit to it.
I had an Android, and when I dropped it, I did go with Apple because of FaceTime, because my daughter is in a situation where she's full Apple because of her work, and it has really good reception. I also have an old iPad I inherited from my mother, and the difference between the reception with the iPhone and the iPad are just, completely different. So I can communicate with her from anywhere, and that was enough to push me over the edge. I have actually found it quite friendly and not really had any problems with it, although I really was an Android fan when I had an Android.
Okay. Gail didn't want to speak up, I guess, but she typed into the chat, I love my iPhone and iPad. It always works. Updates work. Has tons of apps that work. Apps always work. I don't know. I personally have never had a problem with apps on my Android phone, but I don't use an awful lot myself. But I haven't run into any compatibility issues. Updates always do work for me on my Android phone. I probably have a couple of dozen apps installed, and they update quite regularly, successfully. Tom mentions he thinks that there are more Android apps available. I think once you get over a million apps available, comparing the two of them is not terribly useful in terms of deciding one platform over the other. I think most apps are available on both platforms. Certainly any vendor, software vendor out there doesn't really want to cut himself off from basically half the market, you know, so they're gonna keep it up on both platforms.
It's actually a problem though, Chris, when you're looking for a particular app and you don't really know what you're looking for, there are so many which are similar and there are very few good sources which kind of rank them. So it's hard to find one that does what you want without trying a bunch and throwing them away.
Yeah, Tom also mentions best Android phones have better camera than the best of Apple. I think that's a leapfrogging sort of thing. You know, quite often when Apple comes out with their yearly new phones, they will leapfrog over the best put out by Android. I think the darling right now certainly is the brand new Pixels that are out there that has some pretty amazing capabilities. But I mean, on the Apple side is no slouch by any stretch of the imagination on their top end phones. I think the flagship phones, whether it's Samsung, Google, Apple, you know, they're all amazing, amazing devices. And so in terms of raw capabilities, I don't think that most people, if you pick any one of the top tier phones, you'll get a pretty amazing device.
And just to add to what you said about Lineage OS, you said it was Android 8. Now, that's actually not correct. Lineage OS is one of these custom ROMs made by third-party developers. It's very dependent on the model of phone, because what they have to do is they take it's all based on the Android open source project. So the Android code is open source, so people take the open source, they customize it to a particular platform, a particular phone, and typically they work on the phone that they have. So if they have a phone, you know, they develop all kinds of developers are developing different versions of Lineage for different phones. And it could be Android 8, it could be Android 9, and I think I've got Android 9 on my phone right now, and the guy that developed it is working on 10, and I'm sure other people are working on the higher versions too. So if you want to go to a custom ROM, you really have to find out what's available for your particular make and model of phone.
Oh, cool.
So, Jake here. Hi. I have from work an Apple phone, which is by default the size that they gave. It's too small for me, and I don't use it. I use it rarely, only for calling my colleagues. And I have my LG One here, in which I can remove bloatware. It's one of the phones that comes with bloatware, but you can remove applications. A lot of the phones out there, you cannot remove bloatware. You're stuck with them. So this is very good for that. Now, I have a Thai language dictionary on this LG One, and the company does not develop the software as fast as for Apple. So my friend who has Apple, an iPhone, has a very nice interface for the dictionary and all the new stuff, and I'm stuck with this old dictionary interface on this one. But that being said, I'm personally, I prefer the Android for the apps, and basically that's it. It's just a matter of preference. Yeah.
Okay, that's
great.
Fair enough.
Thanks, Eric.
Okay, well, maybe we'll move along. Stuart has a share on a relatively interesting app for Android called Project Trove. You want to talk about this, Stuart? Stuart reaches for a microphone button. Here we go.
On that?
Yep.
Hey, I found this app somewhere that I can't remember. Sat in my wish list for I don't know how long before I finally decided to install it and try it, and I don't recommend it. It's from Microsoft. I thought it was pretty good. Take pictures of things that other people want you to take pictures of and get a few pennies or bucks or whatever. For doing it, but there's nothing active except, in my case, there was take pictures of construction signs with handwritten notes on them. Well, I live in Quebec. If there was a handwritten construction sign, it would be in French. And there aren't any. And this app comes from the United States, so I really doubt that anything would be accepted. So, okay, scrap that one. And the other was take a photograph of your insurance card. We'll redact it for you. Yeah. Wink, wink. Nod, nod. Yeah. Sure. Just like every other big company promising things. No. So I waited for about a month, and the projects never changed. Those were the only two options I had. I believe Alan mentioned that he had a different project available to him.
I tried it today, Stuart. There's only one active project, and it's for hand punch tools or Cat5 cable. Now, I don't know what you punch Cat5 cable for, but apparently you need a tool to do it. And they want pictures of these tools. And I forget how much, it might have been 20 cents or 50 cents or something. Since I don't have a tool and I don't have Cat5, I don't think I can send them any photos.
So as the thing here says, not recommended.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting idea. They're trying to get these photographs for use with artificial intelligence. So I guess they're trying to get algorithms to recognize all these things. So that's what they're after. Anyway, not a particularly useful thing. And it may only be available to people in the States, too. Wasn't clear whether it belonged to Canada or not. Okay, moving along then, we have a really weird question came in, and I'll let Chris take this one.
Yeah, so this came in from Bob Walker, and he was downloading images, and what he was doing was copying and pasting the description of the picture from the website into the file name when he was saving the file, so that it would have the full description rather than just, you know, image one or whatever it was that it came down as. And in both File Explorer as well as Total Commander, which is another file manager, the file name was sometimes coming in bold and italics. And you can see a screenshot over there of how everything below the Z's, there's a couple that are just italicized, and then everything else is bold italicized. And if he copied and pasted the file name into an old editor that he has, Programmer's File Editor, the text part of the description of that image was coming in as question marks. And if he pasted it into Notepad, it actually displayed it correctly. And if he pasted it into Word, it came in correctly. And it showed it switched the font automatically to Cambria Math. And Word would not allow him to change from Cambria Math to anything else. So he sort of wondered, what is going on here? So next slide. So the question marks almost certainly were Unicode characters. And you were pasting them into a program that was not designed to be able to handle Unicode. And so that's typically what it will do, is it will just put in question marks because it can't display, you know, whatever the correct character is on it. Unicode is a huge, huge character set. So Unicode 14, version 14, is over 144,000 different characters. All kinds of languages, Chinese and so forth, are all covered. Symbol sets like crazy in it. So there's a huge amount of characters that are available in Unicode. So I suspect strongly that wherever it was being copied from on the web, they were actually displaying things in Unicode and it was being picked up. However, that doesn't explain everything, because I have absolutely no idea why or how you could actually get a file name to display bold and italics, because my understanding was couldn't be done. So I did a little bit of research on it, and I found that the Microsoft Community website, which is a blog site where, you know, people can contribute questions as well as answers, and somebody put in a question. This is 2 years old, this question. Bold letters and file names, how do I do it? So he's saying he's using Windows 10, and he had a Word file, and he wanted that in File Explorer, it would actually show the file name to be in bold. And he says, how do you do it? And there were a number of answers to it. So things like Windows File Explorer does not support bold and italics for file or folder names. Another one said there is not a way to do this in Windows File Explorer. And a third person said, you can't bold or italicize file names. And this is over 2 years old. Nobody came up with contrary opinion on that, saying that, yes, here's how you go about doing it. So my conclusion is that clearly Bob is spreading fake news, because this cannot be done. So, however, I'm being facetious, folks. You know, Bob did not, you know, fake up a screenshot and italicize some of the file names. I'm sure it's coming from Unicode somehow, but I don't know how you do it. And it should not be allowed to use Unicode characters. Well, actually, I'm not correct on that. You can use Unicode characters in file names. It is possible to do so. It's not recommended, because if you send that file to somebody who, for whatever reason, can't understand that Unicode character, you'll end up getting the question marks. And I have seen that in file names. People who had some songs that they had downloaded from somewhere, and they were clearly Unicode characters in the file name, and it displayed fine. It just had question marks where the Unicode characters were in there. But the idea of having bold and italics, I did not believe is part of Unicode. And everything that I have ever known about Windows File Explorer is that you cannot have a directory entry in the file system that indicates that a file name should be bold or italicized. I don't know how we managed to get this done. So if anybody else has an idea about how you can actually accomplish this, by all means, pipe in. We could take it back to the Microsoft Community Forum and say, here's an example. Now, does anybody know how this was done? And in the absence of any feedback from anybody else, I probably will do that just because I'm curious. You know, it shouldn't be possible, but it obviously is. And so,
you know, Bob Walker here, yeah. As you were explaining the bit about the Unicode and all that, it occurred to me that what's being displayed isn't like something like the letter T. It's a Unicode thing for what looks like an italicized bold letter T.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah, so it's not really that it's being bolded.
It's actually a bold character
in Unicode.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Gotcha. That makes sense now. And so the problem of trying to get it that it's not displayed that way is actually going to be something you'll probably just have to manually type in, because I don't know any way to do a mapping to that bold italicized letter T and tell it that instead just use, you know, a normal U.S. character set, capital T. But yeah, that makes sense for it to be that it's just a Unicode character that is bolded or is italicized. It's not that you're taking a character and then saying apply a style to that. That makes sense.
But also mess up
not only the sorting, but it would also mess up any searches that you might make on the file name.
Because, yeah, exactly.
The Unicode characters would not match the English characters. And although, in fact, many programs that recognize accented characters, they are probably unlikely to match bolded italic characters as well.
Yeah. Yeah, Bob noted as well that anything that looked bold italicized, if he pasted it into Word and then applied italics to it, it made it more italic. And if he applied bold to it, it became bolder. So that, again, supports the idea that it's just the Unicode character that looks like a bold italicized, you know, letter T or whatever the letter is. And, yeah, that would definitely be what's messing up his sort order as well, is that these are just Unicode characters that are way beyond the letter Z. And so it's just sorting them later on like that.
Yeah, because in yeah. File Explorer or in Total Commander, if you sort all the files by file name, these sort out after the Zs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Look at it, the italic F is followed by the italic H, and the boldface B is followed by the boldface T. So there's some kind of logic to how the characters are being sorted.
Yeah.
I think there's a copy as text function in Windows, and instead of you know Control V, it's Control Shift V or something like that, that you might want to try if you want to just paste ASCII text.
I think Bob tried that, but it didn't work. And the reason is that it's not really mapped to, you know, the first case, like the fall in love with the sky, the capital F, you know, it's not anything saying that this is, you know, a capital letter F. It's just a Unicode character. So it's really bizarre that a website would bother to actually use these Unicode characters for the descriptions, unless they're specifically trying to screw around with anybody who copies their content.
Serge Eric, I think, has a comment.
Yes. I don't find this to be a problem for me because I use a Windows Explorer alternative that precisely can bold, italicize, colored lines, and I can even change the font in the Explorer. It's a directory opus. And this is when you have a lot of files and you want some of them to stick out, you can give them a color, you can bold them, you can do many things. So for me, that's practical. But to come back to the problem, no, I've never seen this problem. I never cut and pasted and had an automatic change of
Yeah.
No.
But you're saying this will actually apply it to directory listings so that in Windows File Explorer, it will actually show it as bolded or colored or whatever?
Yes, these are options in the menu that you can bold, change the color, mark with a flag, or a lot of customization that you can do. And you can customize the interface as well of the program.
That's interesting. Wow.
It comes when you get it, it's a paid program when you buy it. It's okay. And I believe there's a 2-month free trial period.
Oh wow.
Yeah. And when you get it, it's very raw. It's a okay. dual pane in Explorer, and that's it. But you can customize it. You can change the background. You can color the background. You can have pictures in the background. You can do a whole bunch of things. Yeah.
So can you put a link to that in the chat window so people can try it?
Sure.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And Jocelyn says he's found a site which will let you write bold Unicode text.
Oh, cool.
There's a link there to do that.
Yeah, I'll have to try that out. That's interesting.
And Tom's got some information on Office for formatting when you paste.
Yeah, and then how to paste text without formatting almost anywhere. So I'd be interested, Bob, if you tried any of those techniques and see if it'll actually remove the formatting and get you back to plain text. Might be also interesting to see a directory listing done at a command prompt, how things actually display there. Be interesting. Thanks, Serge, for the link to that software.
I've posted as well a link to a webpage of mine right now.
Okay.
Where you can see screenshots of interfaces I built over time.
Cool.
And this is very easy. These are options, very, very easy to customize.
Very interesting.
Good stuff. Okay, so we've run out of prepared material, so if anybody has any other things that they want to discuss, we can do that.
Stefan's reports that his microphone seems to be completely broken, so we'll have to push his presentation to next week or after he gets a working microphone. So, Tom, you had your hand up at one point. Sorry, I forgot to even look for hands up. Did you still have something you wanted to
yes.
comment on or... did you put it all in the chat?
An open question right at the front end.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Backup solution when you're using a network attack storage?
Yeah. I saw that when it went by, and I thought of some ideas behind it. Basically, the whole idea of a network attack storage is that all your devices that are on your side of the network should have access to it as plain storage. So my initial thought is using it for backup would be just use regular backup software, and when you're asked for the location of where you put your images or plain files, if you're just synchronizing files, would be to just point to the NAS device, and everybody who uses it would either have a separate folder on there, or you could have folders by devices. So you could have Chris's PC and, Sam's PC and whatever. And then you just store the image files there and you go across the network. So that was my initial thought. Is there something in there at all that would be different than what you would expect from that?
It would be nice to have versioning of a variety of files, mainly text files. I wonder what backup software are people using that can back up their documents as well as do image files of their operating system.
Yeah, I use a dual approach on it. So for imaging. I use EaseUS to do backup, but just about any imaging software would be perfectly fine to be able to do that. For versioning on individual files, I use File History built into Windows, and I find that it works really well. And for that, you could definitely point to another device as to where you want your versioned files to go. The really nice thing I think about file history is its configurability. By default, it picks up most of the folders under your profile. You can turn off any of those, and you can add in additional folders. It's folder-based as opposed to file-based, and you can have its frequency that it checks for new or changed files to as fast as every, I think it's 5 minutes, down to once a day. And you can have it keep itself clean by automatically deleting old versions that are older than, say, a year or 6 months or, you know, a week or whatever. I currently am backing up, I forget, probably something about 50 gigabytes. And I've got 2 years worth of versioning on that, and it's less than 100 gigabytes because not that many files in terms of my data files are really changing all that frequently. So that will allow me right from File Explorer to right-click on any file, go to Properties and Versions tab, and then I can pull up any of the previous versions. I can save them out separately. I can overwrite the current version. It's very, very flexible. And the way it stores the files on the backup drive is really nice too, because basically it just saves the file with changing its the file name to include the date and time that the file was backed up. So that's how it keeps all of the versions there, as well as allows it to track what should be cleaned up if it has to be cleaned up. And so it's really, really nice program. So personally, I think that combination of an imaging software, and again, I think any imaging software is perfectly fine. There's lots out there. And then for versioning, file history, I think does a wonderful job as long as you're on Windows 10. For other platforms, there are other pieces of versioning software out there. I'm not familiar with any of the ones outside of file history just because it works really well and it's free and it's in the box with Windows 10.
One more question.
Has anybody used Butter File System, BTRFS?
It's a
nothing popping
yes.
in.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Elizabeth asks, if anybody has a BlackBerry Passport, they would like to chat sometimes. Sorry if this is off topic. Passport 10, and she pastes it in her email address. So if anybody has a BlackBerry Passport 10, you get in touch with her through that.
Okay, so that brings us to the end of tonight. So a couple of extra things. Just a reminder that Tech Cafe starts up again next month, which is basically next week, or November starts next week anyway. The first Tech Cafe is on November the 8th, and it's Bob Walker going to be talking about renewable energy. I just remind you that this is run by the library, and you have to register with the library to get the login credentials for their Zoom session. Our November meeting for the club is on November the 10th, and it's a program on astronomy with a couple of people talking about software that they use to support their astronomy usage, and also on astrophotography. So, and if you read the descriptions in the on the website, it looks like it's going to be a really interesting meeting. So that's Wednesday, November the 10th. And in the meantime, our next Q&A session is next week, which is November the 3rd. And as usual, if you have any questions or solutions to things we've talked about, topics that you want to share, send us a heads up to the suggestion box email address, and we'll be happy to add you to the deck.
Just before we close off, Tom had a final thing on asking about AOME as a backup solution imaging. I did a comparison of four image backup software back a couple of years ago when I was trying to get away from TrueImage, and that was one of the ones I looked at. It was really neck and neck for me and my use case between that and Ease Us to do backup. the one thing I'll comment on AOMA is their translation from whatever Southeast Asian language there is native to them to English was, shall we say, a little creative sometimes. So it was a little bit of a struggle a few times looking through the manual, but I usually figured it out. Great software. One of the things that's really good about theirs was that they had one price for a one-year subscription or something like that, or just the current version. Or you could get a lifetime, which I presume means their lifetime and not my lifetime, for I think it was less than double. You would get a lifetime subscription to get all new versions that they come out with. So it was really nice software. It was very capable. I thought it was quite good. If you can't find the article that I wrote on our website, if you look, finding a backup program or something like that, if you search for that, you'll find the article. If you can't find it, let me know, and I'll send you the URL to that. Okay, I think we've covered off all the questions. If anybody had any last-minute things, by all means, jump in. Otherwise, we'll keep it till next week. Okay, thanks all, and I will stop the recording.